This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Just a reminder that the Kermode Advent Calendar is up and running. And it has all kinds of rants and bits and pieces, and it repays a daily visit. A daily dose. Fancy waking up with you.
There's only one person in the world who does that.
Yes, but have you checked out? Have you checked yourself out on the Kermode Advent Calendar? It is a treat.
They showed me the first one today, which was me being rude about 50 cent movie. Yeah, and is it me being rude about something every day of the
there's
month?
There's all kinds. You know, there's facts and figures and quizzes and questions and all kinds of bits and pieces and assorted rants. Absolutely, I've never seen so many emails coming in. We haven't really talked about anything much apart from best use of American cars in movies. Thelma and Louise, Carl and Elton.
Yeah, that's a good moment.
Blues Brothers, lots of people suggesting.
Christine, presumably.
Haven't got there yet. Even though I haven't the faintest interest in cars, could I nominate the 6000 SUX in Robocop as the car I wouldn't want to touch with a micturation cove? Have I got that wrong?
Well, micturation
is... Micturation cove.
That presumably comes from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, doesn't it?
Well, in which case I should know about it. I think it went...
Thy micturations are to me as flurgid gamma blotchets on a lurgid beat, isn't it?
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
And we'll...
The Vogon, you know, thingy.
A Vogon poetry.
Yeah.
What about Matt Damon driving a Mini in The Bourne Identity? Surely a very cool driving sequence in it. Anyway, a Mini. We're talking about American cars.
Yeah,
clearly,
exactly.
That
Mini,
qualify.
Clearly not American.
Box office top 10, before we go any further at all. Saw 3 is at 10.
There it goes. And stop having your fainting fits. Leave the St. John's Ambulance alone.
Step Up at 9.
Nothing like as bad as everybody said. It's just, you know, being reviewed by a bunch of old fogies.
Pan's Labyrinth. The movie of the year, according to some, and it's in at 8.
I mean, I honestly don't know what else to say other than you have to go and see it. It is a real kind of, you know, friend divider. And if people love it, then they may be embraced and loved and welcomed into the bosom of your family. And if they don't like it, they should be shunned and thrown out into the, you know, sixth circle of hell. Because it is one of those things when there is an absolute right and an absolute wrong. I've had so much flack from people saying, how can you say it's the Citizen Kane of... how can you say it's Citizen Kane of fantasy movies? It doesn't make sense. Yes,
does everyone who doesn't agree with you speaks in a silly voice?
Everyone who doesn't agree with me speaks in that silly voice. And that's why I answer in this voice.
Okay,
it's a masterpiece.
This is the reason for the mass of communication. Peter Morris, the advert for Pan's Labyrinth in The Independent has 18 quotes, but not one from Mark. Does he feel left out?
The fact is that there are 18 great quotes for Pan's Labyrinth just means that, for once, everyone has finally woken up and realised Guillermo del Toro's brilliance.
Christian, if unreliable, Christian in West London, responding to the Good Doctor's enthusiasm, I persuaded my girlfriend, not a big fan of fantasy, to see Pan's Labyrinth. It was a long way to fall from Mark's giddy review. It's humorless, brutal and disappointing. It's like a bad Amelie meets Downfall if made by Clive Barker. It really is an achievement to make even an animated insect irritating. Please insert a T after the word pan in the title. We continue. Stuart in Lally. He actually doesn't know what to say.
As Jeremy just said, you know, we live in a democracy and everyone is entitled to an opinion. It's just that mine's correct.
Stuart in London, after listening to the Good Doctor's rave review about the up-and-coming Pan's Labyrinth, I've just sent off for a copy of The Devil's Backbone, which he referred to as good reference material for Pan's Labyrinth. I hope it will be as good as the reviews. I've looked at the trailers with both my daughters, aged 14 and 11, for Pan's Labyrinth, but I am unsure what age would be
15.
Suitable.
It's a 15 certificate film, and Guillermo, who has a 10-year-old, would not take it. It's not a kid's film. It's a top level 15. It is tough. The war stuff is tough. It is not a kid's film.
Nida says, just thought I'd mention when I went to see Pan's Labyrinth, I had an exhilarating feeling of discovering a new depth to the world around me and felt drunk on the newness and brightness of a fairy tale that was at once childlike and tremendously adult.
You see...
Hang on. We're only halfway through Sued's Corner at the moment. I haven't felt like this about a story since I was a kid, reading Narnia or Lord of the Rings, and as a dull, cynical adult, I never thought I'd feel it again.
Aye.
Being proved wrong was invigorating and uplifting and just world-alteringly fantastic. Sorry if that's a bit florid, says Nida, but I thought Mark's elaboration on why it was life-changing, it made me feel happier, lacked a certain oomph.
Well, God bless your veins and your arteries. Who's that from?
Nida O'Leary.
Well, hats off to you. That's exactly what I would have said had I been as eloquent.
Or florid. Richard in Ashford. I took my 15-year-old son to see Pan's Labyrinth last week prior to listening to your review, based purely on your previous gushing praise. We were not disappointed.
Hey.
This is addressed, I just noticed, to Dr. Kermoden's sidekick. What a marvellous, disturbing and fulfilling film. As we were leaving, I overheard a woman in a guttural Essex voice say, good, I suppose, but it would have been better in English.
What, the Spanish Civil War would have been better in English? It's a problem with it, isn't it?
If you shout loud enough, they understand.
Yeah.
Went to see Pan's Labyrinth, says, and fabulous, 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 extraordinary and fabulous. Far more scary than something like Saw 3. Can't recommend it enough. If there is a film made of my favourite book this year, Shadow of the Wind, I hope it is as good as this, says Anne Moore. Fantastic. And there's absolutely buckets of it.
And are they generally in favour?
In general they are, apart good. From that one who thought it was absolutely toe-curlingly, terribly
Pants,
tedious.
Yeah. Well, as I said, it is always good to have a difference of opinion. And also, in a way, I think I would be more disturbed if somebody said, "It's all right." Because it's actually really disliking it. As I think the Pretenders said, there's a thin line between love and hate. Although, in my case, I hate Nick Brunfield's films and I'm not going to suddenly fall in love with them. But in a way, that sort of extreme reaction is less problematic to me than somebody just going, "Well, I saw that Pan's Labyrinth, it was all right, but, you know, it wasn't Star Wars, was it?"
Rob in London... actually, we'll get on to this. There's so much of this. What we need to do is finish the top 10 and then we can start doing reviews. And all this correspondence is welcome and we'll get through as much as we can before 4 o'clock. But we're only at number 8.
Yes.
At 7, The Prestige.
As I said before, pretty much the equivalent of cinematic Sudoku, but very well done and a good performance by Michael Caine.
So cinematic Sudoku, so that's good and engaging if you're into that kind of thing.
Exactly. And I know a lot of people who have seen The Prestige and thought that actually what it was a bit too clever for its own good and not emotionally engaging. I mean, I have to say, I did find it emotionally engaging, but I understand when people say it's a little bit clever for its own good.
Now we have Doom 2 at 6, D-H-O-O-M. Is this...
No, which I haven't seen. It wasn't shown to us.
Is it an indie film?
It is, yeah, and it's a sequel. And apparently from the one review that I have seen, somebody has gone to see it, I'm going to have to go see it in cinema. It's a slick, it's 150 minutes long, and it's pretty empty stuff. But as I said, I haven't seen it. If somebody else has seen it, please send us an email and let us know.
At number 5, Jackass number 2.
I mean, the depressing thing is the possibility that there'll be Jackass number 3. I remember years ago campaigning for Sick, The Life and Death of Bob Flanagan's Supermasochist, to be released uncut, because I didn't believe that you should, you know, censor images of people harming themselves consensually. As you know, I'm very much in favour of consensual S&M. People should be able to go and do that sort of stuff. But occasionally, watching Jackass, you think, you know, I kind of long for the days when the BBFC would have taken one look at this and said, "Nope, you're not doing that in public, Sonny Jim."
Number 4, Tenacious D, The Pick of Destiny.
Tenacious D.
Well, actually, what I've got here is Tenacious D. What did I say?
Tenacious.
That's actually quite good.
It is, yeah. That's after 9 dacious and 8 dacious, but before 11 dacious.
It's the Jack Black School of Rock that isn't quite School
but
of Rock.
But School of Rock for grown-ups. And the thing about School of Rock was... what
School of Rock was for grown-ups.
No, but the lovely thing about School of Rock was what mediated its meathead philosophies was the fact that all the time he was having this dialogue with the kids, and it was a PG-rated movie, and that was one of those things in which reining him in made him funnier. Taking the gloves off and just allowing him and his partner to F and blind and, you know, and get on with the usual heavy metal, sweary Mary nonsense. Actually, it's just dull. I mean, it's just not funny. It is just like, you know, yeah. Bill and Ted, funny. Tenacious D, not funny.
Rob in London. I keep starting this and thinking, no, actually, there's not time because it's going to take us into all kinds of...
Rob in London is listening on the end of going, go
Rob
on.
In London, I'm just not going to read out your email at all, actually. Santa Claus 3, our favourite at 3.
You know, cinematic equivalent of tertiary syphilis and everything evil, bad, vile, putrescent and filthy and stinky in the world all got together in one coagulated ball of slime and thrown at your cinema screens to remind you that, hey, it's Winterville.
Borat's at number 2.
You know, still not funny, still being buoyed aloft by middle-class people who think that, you know, academic Brits laughing at Americans is funny. As I said before in the first time I reviewed it, there are moments which suggest a philosophy, but there are many more moments that suggest a slump into smugness, which does not find favour with me.
And The UK's number one, no surprise, Casino Royale.
And the only thing I have to say, and I've said it before, I'll say it again, 12 certificate, do not take your kids to see Casino Royale. You listening, everyone? Not for young kids. For older people above the age of 12. Not for young kids due to the extended flagellation torture scene, which is not for young kids. I like it, but I'm 43.
Ben on this says, could you ask the good doctor to chastise my brother-in-law for taking his two daughters, seven and six, to the latest Bond film? He was talking about it over dinner last Sunday, was complaining that he took them to see a cheesy Bond film, hoping to have tons of double entendres and bad one-liners, but was genuinely shocked at its content. I did try and point out that it was rated at 12A, therefore it is only suitable for children 12 or over. I know he listens to your programme every Friday, and I suggest a commodian chastisement so he understands what a 12A rating actually means. This is Ben's brother-in-law.
Well, the general rule, as we've said before, 12 is, it's 12 and above unless you have particular reason to believe that your children are up to it. But there was an almost mandatory, but a generally accepted, 8 is the lowest limit. And I mean the lowest limit. And personally, I wouldn't actually take anyone below the age of, below the age of 12.
So Ben's brother-in-law, you could say, is a really bad father.
No, I'm not going to say that because I mean, he's probably a lovely person. And actually, it's very easy for people to see Bond because Bond is such a brand name. You just think it's the new Bond film. We all saw Bond films, but we are in a different league now. You know, the world has moved on. The world is not enough.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. But there we go. You know.
The odd review or two of a new movie. Maybe we'll get to if you could only stop sending in emails about interesting topics. And Rob in London. No, I don't think so. This email from Paul Williams. Simon and Mark, I'm now listening to the show with bated breath. I am the director of the movie London to Brighton.
Oh, so Paul Andrew Williams.
Yes. I have been waiting all my career for a review from the man himself. Is he going to? Of course it is, if it's going to be a stinker. Should Paul Andrew Williams, director of London to Brighton, stay with us till four?
Well, shall I blow the gaff or shall I
I think we should just leave him in suspense.
I think he should be left in... what did you just say?
Suspense.
Oh, so, that's not what you said.
Let's do a review or two before four, as that's what you're here for.
OK, so, big movie out this week, Stranger Than Fiction, which is this sort of sub-Pirandello, sub-Charlie Kaufman comedy-drama about a boring taxman, played by Will Ferrell in his, you know I used to be crazy, wacky Will Ferrell, but now I'm sort of more serious, post sort of Truman Show period, sub-Jim Carrey, blah, blah, Will
it's
Ferrell.
Going well, isn't it?
Yeah. Discovers that he is a character in a book. The book is being written by a famous author, played by Emma Thompson, who is famous for the fact that she always kills her central character at the end of a book. So he is a real, live, breathing person who is a character in a story being narrated by Emma Thompson. Here's a clip.
Harold assumed his watch was simply on the fritz and never even considered that it might be trying to tell him something. In fact, Harold had never once paid attention to his watch other than to find out the time. And honestly, it drove his watch crazy. And so, on this particular Wednesday evening, as Harold waited for the bus, his watch suddenly stopped.
Sorry, does anyone have the time?
Thus, Harold's watch thrust him into the immitigable path of fate. Little did he know that this simple, seemingly innocuous act would result in his imminent death.
What? What? Hey! Hello? What? Why? Why my death? Hello? Excuse me? When?
You get the sort of general idea. Now, in a way, it's easier to describe what the film isn't than what it is.
What isn't it, then?
Well, I mean, it isn't, as it says on the poster quotes, funny and profound, comedy at its very best, or smart, ingenious and heartwarming, which is what the quoted reviews have said. It's a script by Zach Helm and not a script by Charlie Kaufman, who, you know, gave us Being John Malkovich or An Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. It's nowhere near as good as them. It's directed by Mark Forster, who did, I think, Finding Neverland and Stay, who isn't Michel Gondry with The Best Will in the World. Nor is it I Heart Huckabees. It's a lot better than I Heart Huckabees, despite the fact that it has in it Dustin Hoffman playing one of those wacky, twitchy, edgy characters exactly like he does in I Heart Huckabees. It is clearly his great big character trope for the one in this, in which he plays a literary professor who the Will Ferrell character goes to see to say, look, I'm a character in a book, what do I do? And the literary professor, as played by Dustin, is constantly drinking coffee. It's like, do you remember that thing the comic strip Presents Strike, when the woman who was Meryl Streep always had to have an apple in her hand because it was the key to her character. Well, in this way, he always has to have a cup of coffee in his hand because that's clearly the key to his character. At one point, Will Ferrell's character goes to see Monty Python's Meaning of Life, and it isn't that either, because it's nothing like as anarchic as Monty Python. It's nothing like as funny as Monty Python. It isn't anything like as funny or offbeat or kooky or crazy as it needs to be. Now, neither is it awful. What it is mildly ambitious, but very, very moderately successful. And I can tell you exactly the moment that I knew that I was parting company with it, and it came here. There's a moment in it which the Will Ferrell character, who's a tax man, who's got all this narration going on in his head, is having or beginning to have a relationship with a young woman whose tax he has been auditing. And in order to demonstrate his inner soul, he goes out and he buys a guitar and he sits on the couch and he starts playing a song to her, and he's just playing two chords. And this is to demonstrate that he's got this kind of punk rock sensibility in him. And suddenly he starts singing Whole Wide World by Reckless Eric. Now, this is very important to me. You have to bear with me on this. There's a couple of movies that have used Whole Wide World by Reckless Eric in the past. Famously, Chris Pettit's Radio On, which is a road movie set in England. We know in America, a road movie, you go from California to New York or the other way around. In Britain, a road movie, you start in London, you go to Bristol. You get there really fast, and that's it. But there's a great scene where they go into a cafe and they play Whole Wide World by Reckless Eric. And there's another more recent example, Damien O'Donnell's Heartland.
Which we were talking about with Mike Machine the other day. Just a few days
and
ago.
I was down in Bristol doing a short film festival, and Damien O'Donnell was there. And every time I see him, I feel the need to embrace him and say, you and Whole Wide World. When I was growing up, Whole Wide World was pretty much my favourite record. I remember really clearly one afternoon in the late 1970s going up to the Stiff Shop in London with me and a girl called Lauren Auerbach, who was a dead ringer for Lena Lovitch, and she had a big thing about Lena Lovitch. And we went into the Stiff store, and there was a Reckless Eric poster on the wall, and I said, I want to buy that. And the guy behind the counter said, all right, do you want me to sign it for you? And I said, well, why would you do that? He said, well, because it's me, isn't it? And of course, it was Reckless Eric signing behind the counter. And it's just a
thing.
That's
another one of your impressions.
But that's actually quite a good Reckless Eric, but like, I've been doing it like since I was 16. 15. No, I'm 14 even.
Too much autobiography
general. No, but the point about this is,
yes,
it's very hard to play Whole Wide World by Reckless Eric and lose my sympathy. And yet, when it happened in Stranger Than Fiction, all I thought was, no, 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 no. You don't have the right to use this. You haven't earned it. You're not going to get away with it, and it's not going to work. And it was really talismanic for me that at the point, I mean, and under almost any other circumstance, I tell you, in the middle of Pirates of the Caribbean, if they'd stopped and played Whole Wide World by Reckless Eric, I would have said, you know what? It's not that bad. But in this, I just went, no, 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 no. It's not terrible, but it's just so bland and so unaccomplished and so unremarkable that the use of Whole Wide World just sank it for me. And from then on, it was just a losing battle.
So basically, you can redeem almost any film by putting Reckless Eric in there.
No, but the point that I was making, I think I made it some length.
No, you did, and please don't make it again.
Okay.
Nathan in Bristol. No, I don't want to do that. Here's a good one. David in Bristol.
Are you in a strop today?
No. So I saw Mark at my local bar in Bristol last Friday. It was raining quite heavily, and as he left with a lady friend to get into a taxi, I could see from his facial expression he was troubled, confused, and in a real quandary. As it was pouring with rain and he didn't have an umbrella, did he A, hold his briefcase above his own head and protect his carefully groomed trademark bonnet whilst walking to the taxi, or B, hold his briefcase above his lady friend's head to protect her and risk ruining his quiff? You'll be pleased to know he chose the latter, but he didn't half look silly following all the way around the car whilst holding what looked like quite a heavy briefcase above her head, then back around the car with it above his own. Anyway, I went to see Pan's Labyrinth yesterday, and his review and statement about it being one of the films of the year was spot on.
Great.
Good to see he has more than one use.
Can I just say, firstly, two things. Firstly, I was being chivalrous, but I know exactly that the events, and as the joke goes, that was no lady friend, that was Ken Russell's wife. That was Lissy. That is the magnificent Lissy. And it is absolutely true that as we came out of the thing to go, because I was doing it on stage with Ken, I did have a moment in which I did genuinely wonder whether my hair was more important than hers. But it was fleeting, and I fought it.
Chris in Saltash, one of many, just to be pedantic, Meryl Streep didn't hold an apple.
It was an orange. Sorry. Yeah. Well, there we go.
Please.
What?
Get it right.
Well, I did. At the point of correction, I did get it right. It was years ago. It was in the 80s.
All right. So if I hadn't corrected you, you'd have got it right anyway.
No.
Don't forget the podcasts. There is a weekly Mark Kermode podcast. You can carry them around with you every single day and listen to the reviews and just check them over. And we do know if people actually on flights, they take their little MP3 player and before they, you know, they have a selection of movies to watch and then they check your review and then they watch whatever they want to watch.
I got on a flight once and a guy sat next to me and he said, "What should I watch?" And I thought, "Oh, blimey." So I said, "Oh, Crash was on, not the Cronenberg Crash." The other guy said, "You should watch Crash, right? You know." And he said, "Really?" I said, "No, it's great. It's really, really good." And he started watching it. And then, of course, it gets to that great moment. About, the guy was in floods of tears but because he had the headphones on. And I was just thinking, I'd done this to him. I mean, he liked the film, but it was very moving.
Now, Paul Andrew Williams, who emailed a while back, he's the director of London to Brighton. He's still waiting, hanging around. So do we get to his movie now?
Well, we will. Let's do something else first, and then we'll do that. Because there's the two which make an interesting pair. First, Big Nothing, which is... The title is really asking for it, isn't it? You know, Big Nothing. You know, why not call it Why Bother, or Why Am I Here, or How Long Is This Going On, or Is It Still Here, or Did I Leave the Gas On, or blimey, isn't that Simon Pegg? What's he doing in this? It's meant to be a blackly comic crime thriller, which is not funny and not thrilling. And it desperately wants to be like Fargo or like Sam Raimi's A Simple Plan. The story is Simon Pegg with an American accent, which is actually better than David Schwimmer's American accent, which is funny because I think David Schwimmer actually is American, horse-faced old bore that he is. And them and a young woman conspire at the beginning to do a scam whereby they are blackmailing somebody who has been accessing an illegal porn site. And it seems like a simple scam, but of course everything goes wrong and Mimi Rogers ends up with an axe in her head and a whole bunch of everything. And it's all that, it's that thing which is so hard to get right, which is the balance between comedy and, you know, and sort of slightly off-kilter, semi-goreness. And I really like Simon Pegg, and I'm looking forward to Hot Fuzz, and he was great in Shaun of the Dead, which did that thing, that moment in Shaun of the Dead when he's, you know, he's faced with the awfulness of what's going on, and despite the fact that it's funny and it's a zombie movie, is actually very moving, and I think that he's a very good performer, and he's completely trying his best in this, but it's just dross. I mean, it's really, really depressing dross, and it's directed by... the director of that very good little weirdy horror movie, Dead End, which has been ripped off so many times since then, but demonstrating none of the flair of Dead End. I mean, it really, like I said, it's one of those things in which the title says it all, Big Nothing, there we go, there's the review. Also out this week, London to Brighton, which arrives with enormously positive reviews on the poster. Best British film of the century, according to The Big Issue. I think it's a bit early to judge that. I mean, as one who is given to hyperbole, as I think we have established, I still think saying best film of the century when we're in, what is it, 2000 and, are we in six or seven
it's
now?
Still 2006.
Six, though. Yeah. I mean, that, I make it, there's another 94 years of cinema to go, so it's a bit early to say.
Maybe they just missed off the word so far.
What, the best film of the century so far?
Yes, would that help?
Well,
anyway, yeah, look, okay, Paul fine. Andrew Williams has been waiting for ages for your review. Okay. Is it any good?
So the story is, at the very, very beginning, we're introduced to these two characters, a young girl and a middle-aged woman. The young girl is terrified. The middle-aged woman has obviously been horribly battered. And they have to get out of London to go to Brighton. They are being chased by people we are not sure whom. It then turns out, in flashback, that there's an incredibly grim story about how they got here. The young woman is a prostitute who has been roped in to recruit this young girl for absolutely hideous, nefarious ends. Somebody has ended up dead and they are on the run from it, and they go to Brighton being pursued by nasty people. Now, it's interesting because it's a British crime thriller, but it, you know, it is much closer to Mike Leigh than it is to Lock, Stock. I mean, there's nothing leery or larky or, you know, fun or engaging about the villains. They're just pathetic, nasty, sleazy people. And I have to say, it is a tough film. It is also a very accomplished piece of work. And I say that because to say I enjoyed it would be wrong, but I definitely suffered in it in a way that one ought to. One of the most impressive things about it is that Lorraine Stanley, who's the kind of the very tough working girl figure in a minute, we're introduced to her in a way which allows us to know her much more than you would think from the dialogue. The thing I was reminded of was there's a Pat Barker novel called Blow Your House Down, which is about the lives of prostitutes in a sort of circumstance which is kind of vaguely similar to the Yorkshire Ripper environment. And it's a really brilliant novel because you really do meet these people as people. You know, the fact that they are working women, they are women first, and they are, you know, the work they do is very, very secondary. And it's very hard to get that right, particularly in cinema. And I felt this did do that. It also has a very strong performance from this young actress, Georgia Groom, who I've not seen before. Apparently her previous experience includes being a live reporter on John Craven's News Round. And there's real talent there. There is real there is a purpose to it. I mean, it is a film about homelessness. It is a film about the extreme degradation of people in circumstances of poverty. And it is incredibly grueling. And despite the fact it's actually visually fairly discreet, it's a very tough ride. I know a couple of people who think it is the very best British film they've seen all year. I think it's a very fine and admirable piece of work. As I said, I would be lying if I said I enjoyed it. And in fact, I think one of the problems it's got is that I found it so tough, not just the subject matter, but the way in which it dealt with the subject matter is so tough that it's a hard ride. But there is a purpose to it, and it does move towards something which is vaguely uplifting. And I think it is to be admired for taking those people in that absolutely marginalised circumstances and treating them as people first and their circumstances secondly. And when I compare somebody's work to Pat Barker, I don't say that lightly.
Now, a lot of kids home from school, and of course we're entering that season where we shall be getting all kinds of seasonal offerings, and we have a sort of an animation to consider.
It's the new Aardman, and you know, with every new Aardman comes a great whooping of joy, because you know what I thought about Wallace and Gromit: Curse of the Were-Rabbit. I just thought it was absolutely wonderful. So Flushed Away, the latest from the Aardman DreamWorks, you know, collaborative team. Story of a posh... Now, it's a mouse. I have to say, watching the film, I thought it was a posh rat, but actually it's a mouse. A posh mouse... Who's living in a posh house?
Between a posh mouse and a posh rat, then?
Well, a mouse is not a rat.
I know.
But when they're standing upright wearing jackets and tails, it's kind of hard to tell. Okay, fine. A posh mouse, at the beginning, living in a posh house, due to complicated circumstances, gets flushed away down the toilet and is sent into this underworld in the sewer where there are rats and frogs and slugs. As always with Aardman, a terrific array of voice artists, including Hugh Jackman, Kate Winslet, Andy Serkis, Andy Lord Serkis, Bill Nighy. And in this particular clip, a sort of slimy Sir Ian McKellen and Jean Reno. Now, one of the things I should say about the film is there's a healthy dose of anti-French humour in it.
Ah.
Jean Reno as Le
Get
Frog.
Your thumbs up,
exactly.
Then.
Here we go.
You incompetent cheese eaters! You let them escape! It's obvious I should never have sent rodents to do an amphibian's job. Where is he? Why is he always late? Ooh.
Oh, God. Oh, hurry!
The frog.
Bonjour.
You're late, the frog.
Fashionably late, my annoying English cousin. I know no other way.
Now listen, Rita and her new accomplice have stolen something irreplaceable.
It's all right, boss. We've got another one.
A master cable of unique design and purpose. I want it back.
Don't worry. I'll get it back for you.
Once it is returned, my plan will be complete. To wash away, once and for all, the curse, the scourge of... rats.
I think, as you can hear from that, there's an awful lot of the usual Aardman stuff which we've come to know and love. I mean, it's an Aardman production, so there's loads of stuff going on screen. The action sequences are really exciting.
It's not Nick Park.
It's not, no, it's not. And it's been made in America. And crucially, it's been made with CG, with computer graphics, largely because there's an awful lot of water in it. It's very hard to plasticine animate water. It just takes an awfully long time. Now, they have gone out of their way to attempt to replicate the movements of the solid plasticine animation with computers, not to suddenly be completely swept away by what the computer graphics allow them to do. You can see fingerprints virtually on the CG characters. So they've really tried to use the CG as a way of doing plasticine animation. And I think it's a worthy effort, but I have to say, in the end, it doesn't work for me as well as the straightforward stop-motion animation that I know and love from Wallace and Gromit. Wallace and Gromit, Curse of the Were-Rabbit, was one of the best-lit films. Well, it was the best-lit film of that year, and it was certainly one of the best-lit films of the century so far, if we're going to be using that phrase from now on. The problem with Flushed Away is that you do lose something. I mean, it may be that in future CG graphics will get to the point that they can absolutely stand as a substitute for claymation and modelmation, but they haven't got there yet. The other thing is, it's not as rigorously scripted and as rigorously characterized as the very best Aardman stuff. But in saying that, it is necessary to say that Aardman's benchmark is so high that a not completely on the ball Aardman movie is still, I mean, when you're looking at things like Barnyard and Open Season, I mean, we're talking different leagues. Okay, we're talking whole different ball games. And I am judging Arden against their own yardstick, and it's very, very hard to do. It is not, by any means, one of the best Ardmans. That does not mean that people shouldn't go and see it, and that young kids will enjoy it to pieces, and that I will enjoy it a second time round in the same way that I did the first time round. I don't think it has the depth and the resonance, and certainly not the visual richness that I loved in Wallace and Gromit, but it's entirely possible that is something that's, you know, more bothersome for me as an old grump, you know, because I love the way that Curse of the Were-Rabbit looked so much like a Hammer film. I also think that, you know, the scripting isn't quite as rigid. I could have done with more of the genuinely Englishness, you know, which I think was so much a part of Nick Park's animations. But that said, when it's up against the other Digimations that are out there at the moment, it is still better than them. And, you know, if I'm disappointed, it's probably because, like I said, the mark is so high, the watermark is so high, it's very difficult to hit again.
One final piece of correspondence just to clear up. Angus, I was wondering what the Good Doctor's opinion would be on the new parent and baby screening sessions that are currently being publicised by various cinemas. And we talked about before about the 12A bits and pieces, but apparently Casino Royale is the latest of these. This is where, basically, people who can't get to go to the movies because they've got kids, they come along, they park the kids, but in general they're too young to even notice these things. And Angus, in a very long letter, basically wants to know what you think of parent and baby screenings.
Can I say that without, I mean, uncharacteristically, having not thought this through, I can't give you an answer because I don't know. I mean, my feeling is that anything that enables, you know, mums to go and see films properly is a great thing. But I don't know. Give me a week and I'll think of it. And can I very quickly say in the final 10 seconds, the other film that's out this week, Short Bus, famous for being the most explicit film the BBFC have passed, blah, 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 blah. But it's not a film about sex. It is a film about people and relationships, and it's funny and sweet and charming. And it's a hardcore movie with a softcore heart, but it is absolutely for adults only.
Movie of the week?
Short Bus, oddly.
Oh, right, OK. So the movie of the week, and we get 10 seconds.
Well, there was other
what
business,
wasn't there?
What kind
of planning is that?
Let me start earlier.
Hopeless.
You have what's-his-name on, talking about the cars.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find out about other BBC podcasts, including the new Ashes Test Match Special podcast, go online bbc.co.uk/cricket.